Hi, I'm TJ, and I'm golfing in Addison, Illinois, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is wonderful to be here with you today for show number 974. And what we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. As always, we say hello to Bob Ferguson, who is our engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studio. And happy Father's Day to all the dads out there. You know, as Father's Day weekend is upon us, we might reflect a little bit on the lessons our dads taught us. Things like a firm handshake, responsibility, and paying our debts, even if that debt is more than 10 years old. Some Chicagoans were surprised recently when they received moving violations dating back to 2010. These violations were mailed to people, and at first, many thought that they were being scammed, but nope, it's the real deal. Block Club Chicago reported this story earlier in the week. Apparently, the city is a bit backlogged when it comes to some moving violations, and they're catching up on collecting fines. I was kind of shocked. I mean, I feel like the city's Department of Revenue is Johnny on the spot with those violation collections. They're so good at getting our money. As Block Club reports, quote, "The good news, or bad news, is that the notices are actually part of the city's vehicle and commercial ticket debt relief program, which began in April and allows residents to settle ticket debt without late fees if they pay by the end of June," end quote. Okay, so maybe you recently got a speed camera ticket from the Obama administration, but hey, you don't have to pay any late fees on that ticket if you take care of it this month. Getting one of those violations in the mail is just the worst feeling. And I think it's even worse when you see a red light camera or a speed camera as you're rolling through the intersection or your speedometer is just a little too high. You know what will be arriving in your mailbox in a few days, or in this case, a few years. It's a harsh lesson in responsibility, but as my dad reminded me growing up, always pay your debts. And speaking of responsibility, on today's show, we explore the city of Chicago's responsibility to neighborhood environments, and we get an update on the air quality monitoring program. And we should be responsible for kicking back with some good tunes, right? Yeah. We discover the secret history of a very important jazz and blues drummer from the 20th century from right here in Chicago. Chicago is working on installing a network of air pollution monitors in the city. These monitors can be helpful when it comes to keeping track of the air pollution levels in certain neighborhoods. However, the installation of these monitors is not what we might call fast. The city hopes to have them installed in a year, but many are hoping that the city isn't backing away from the promise of these monitors and releasing their data to the public. Anthony Moser is the board president of the Neighbors for Environmental Justice. That's an environmental advocacy group on the southwest side of Chicago. The website, n4ej.org. And Anthony is here with us once again on Outside the Loop. Anthony, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you here. So we've talked about this issue before, so we're just kind of getting an update, but to get everyone on the same page here, in case we're not aware, certain communities in Chicago are more impacted by air pollution than others. Can you just briefly explain the background here?
Yeah. Essentially, the reason that is true is that Chicago has a history of using zoning and development strategies to concentrate industrial pollution in certain neighborhoods, right? Primarily on the south side and the southwest side, mostly in communities of color and in lower income communities.
So that's kind of the background here. And okay, we know that this is a problem and people have been complaining. So we've talked about how there's this initiative to put these air pollution monitors up on light posts in certain areas of the city so we could actually have some empirical data here. But as we've mentioned before, politics kind of plays a role in this. There was the forced resignation of the person who had been leading the air monitoring program. There was also the city's Healthy Chicago 2025 report that was released in December. It didn't mention the air quality monitoring and climate justice that was kind of in the appendix. So let's talk about the concern here. Is the concern that the city has been shifting away from the air pollution issue? What's the worry here?
Well, I guess to back it up a little bit, this has never been a project that the city kind of volunteered to undertake. What happened is, if folks remember the General Iron fight, basically, which is when the city tried to facilitate the move of a scrap metal shredder from the north side in Lincoln Park, where it had been for like 100 years, down to the southeast side, where there was already a neighborhood with a substantial amount of pollution, and they were going to kind of move it in there and just add more, because they wanted to have more development on the north side. And as part of that long, drawn-out fight, some of the community groups filed complaints with the federal government, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development came back and essentially said, yeah, actually, this is part of a pattern of Chicago doing this for a long time in a very deliberate way, and you need to address it. And the city kind of didn't want to do that at first, and eventually they were kind of compelled to sit down with HUD and negotiate an agreement to address that pattern. This air monitoring network is part of that agreement. It was signed just before Mayor Lightfoot left office, and included, committing to putting up air monitors, especially in the communities that have been disproportionately burdened with air pollution. So that's how kind of the whole thing got started. It wasn't like something that they were super excited to do, really. Right. But the result of a lot of pressure and fighting. Then, as you mentioned, the person who had been working in the Department of Public Health to oversee this project and kind of shepherd it along was abruptly pushed out in the fall. And that kind of led to a stalled period where there wasn't a lot happening. We have continued to try and exert pressure on the city to keep this project moving. And there is basically the plan, as we currently understand it, is that the city is forming an advisory board made up of neighborhood organizations that are, you know, interested in this work and have been a part of it, who are supposed to then gather community input and advise the city on the location of the monitors. Basically, the city has accepted applications from groups to become part of that board, but the board itself has not been finalized, and so it also has not met and has not made any decisions about that stuff.
So it seems like there's some movement, but maybe, I don't know, not as quick as we might hope when it comes to this issue?
Yeah, I would say it continues to be something. It does not seem to be a priority. And so it's important that there's still ongoing pressure from community groups and from people who care about this to make sure that it actually happens.
I know that you have started a website, ChicagoAQI.com. I'm guessing that's going to stand for Air Quality Index, ChicagoAQI.com. But this is something where we can participate if we're in an area or we know of an area where we might recommend that an air pollution monitor be placed. This is something that we can get sort of involved with, can't we?
Yeah. So that's something that I built in January when it was not clear, you know, what was happening with the project. And we wanted to go ahead and start the process of taking community input now, or then rather, and we don't want to wait for the city to come around and say, okay, now we're ready, you know, to take suggestions about where the monitors should go. And so, yeah, it's a pretty straightforward tool. People can access it on their phones or on a desktop. You can either just, you know, pick a spot on the map. If you're on your phone, and you can say, use my location, just do it right where you are. And we're really looking for people to offer, you know, their local knowledge, right? Because this stuff is very what we sometimes call hyper local, where it means that if you're on the block next to the asphalt plant, you're going to have a significantly different experience sometimes than people who might only be a couple of blocks away, especially kind of depending on how the wind and the traffic all work. We actually had a pretty bad air quality morning today because the asphalt plant is running and it's getting hot out, and you know, McKinley Park was really, really feeling it. So we encourage people to go to chicagoaqi.com and suggest places where, you know, if it kind of smells funky whenever you drive by a certain place, or if there's you know, kind of a school or like a local hangout where kids are a lot of times, and you want to make sure, you know, what is the air quality like in those places, then, you know, we're really looking for people to share that information with us. And then this is actually going to be an ongoing tool where as the monitors go up, we are going to be adding them to that map as well to be able to compare directly to where the city put the monitors up versus where people were calling for them to go, and also then to be able to start understanding more about air quality in those neighborhoods.
So I have to ask you a little bit more about the politics here, but let's make it on the national level. Donald Trump getting elected to the office of president of the United States and thereby being head of the executive branch. You mentioned the HUD department, Housing and Urban Development. So how has that been? Have you had any more contact with HUD, or has the city, has President Trump had an impact on the possibility of these air monitors going up in a timely fashion?
It's possible that the change at the federal level will have some impact on the agreement that they signed with the city. I don't know. To my knowledge, that has not happened yet. But I do think it represents a significant change in the overall kind of balance of regulatory authority. Unfortunately, for a long time, people in Chicago have had to turn to the state or to the federal government to try and get action to happen locally. Mm-hmm. And now the federal government is really not going to be there as a source of authority or pressure to exert on the city. And that means that the city is going to have to be increasingly responsible for taking on these important environmental issues directly, instead of kind of kicking the can, you know, and kind of passing the responsibility up to a higher regulation.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's why, you know, when you said before that the city has been moving slowly on this, and the priority of this air monitor situation might not be as high as maybe it once was. You know, I think about Mayor Johnson, and he ran as a candidate on environmental justice, especially when it comes to neighborhoods of color. And so I would think, I don't know, that this might be something that would be higher up on the list, but that is not really where we're at right now, if I'm reading this right.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of things that we would like to see addressed environmentally, and so far the city has not demonstrated a lot of interest in prioritizing that work. And, you know, like I said, the federal government being out of the picture kind of in terms of really being active or helping here means that it's going to be on us as a city to take care of this stuff. And, you know, there are still a couple of years left in the term, so maybe it's time to turn it around here. But we are going to continue to push for those changes. I mean, one of the things that we're hoping to see happen in the short term is there is a cumulative impacts ordinance that is up in city council that would be changing some of the development processes, which is really what this kind of all comes back to. Right now, there are parts of the city where you can build a factory or you can build a giant warehouse and you're not really required to get permission. You know, it's zoned for it by right. And you don't have to let the neighborhood know. You don't have to have any kind of consideration of how much pollution is there already. But this ordinance, the Hazel Johnson Cumulative Impacts Ordinance, if that gets passed, it would change the zoning requirements, just requiring that new projects like a big warehouse or a new factory would have to do a cumulative impact study. So basically, they would have to kind of consider how much pollution is already there in the neighborhood, and they'd have to get approval from the city, and they'd have to meet with the neighbors. You know, just a little bit of early warning and discussion so that these things are not zoned by right, which is how it is now.
Well, these issues are so important when it comes to the air we breathe, the environment that we live in. And as we've been talking about historically, that experience has not always been great, depending on where you live in the city of Chicago. So we can check out the website for Neighbors for Environmental Justice, n4ej.org, and the number 4ej.org. And Anthony Moser is the board president of Neighbors for Environmental Justice. That's an environmental advocacy group on the southwest side of Chicago. Anthony, thank you for talking to us today and for all of your hard work. I know it's been quite the journey, but I think you're doing a good thing. So thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
You ain't nothing but a
Oh yeah, once again, connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of Steve Krakow, who is the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music column in the Chicago Reader. He's also a music historian, artist, and musician himself. And, you know, I like this when we can shine a light on, I mean, Steve, what you do here, you're shining a light on musicians who maybe never get that love or attention or fame, but the drummers. You know, the drummers need some love, and you are highlighting Mr. Fred Bilo, born in Chicago in 1926. He is a darn good drummer, isn't he?
Sure is. And you know, you could even say a groundbreaking one, you know. And again, you know, like you're saying, maybe people don't think about that. You know, what? Who innovated a particular rhythm in music? You don't hear that as much as you hear, like, who innovated this guitar lick or, you know, this vocal melody? Sadly, you know, it's kind of gets the backseat a little bit, but you know, pretty important. And you know, Mr. Bilo might have come up with the rhythm of rock and roll as we know it.
That's right. And this is a story where, you know, he's an old school guy, like I said, born in 1926 here in Chicago. We kind of like find out some stuff about him, but there's a lot maybe we don't know. So we're going to piece together here the most thorough story of Fred Bilo. He is one of these examples of studying under the captain Walter Diet at DuSable High School in Bronzeville. He starts on trombone, he switches to drums, and he is at a very early age saying, this is what I want to do with my life.
Yeah, and you know, like, I think a lot about his sort of education and the way he came up in music sort of says a lot about the sort of cross-pollination of genres, you know, because originally he wanted to be a jazz guy, you know, and then he primarily became known as a blues drummer and sort of, you know, made the gap a little smaller between those two genres. And then in sort of in the process, like I said, might have invented the rhythm of rock and roll as we know it. So, you know, it's important to sort of know how the roots of all these genres is, you know, are sort of like so distinct now, but, you know, they all sort of blended at one point.
So he is going to enlist in the army, and this is 1945. He's a soldier. He, as you say here, he's drumming on helmets and boxes when he's in the army. So he's practicing even when he's deployed, and he's going to again enlist in 1948, and he's in Germany. And he is still, like, while he's over in Europe, in Germany, and, like, he would go to Paris, he would still take in music.
I mean, he would play it. He played in, you know, the 427th Army Band, you know, which I think kind of got him around. And it was an all-black band, you know, obviously playing jazz and forms like that. And then while, you know, he was doing that, he could sort of leave Germany and go to Paris and manage to play with all these sort of legends, Coleman Hawkins, Erskine Hawkins, James Moody, Kenny Clarke, all these guys that were over there. So, you know, he was sort of getting a musical education, you know, while in the army.
That's amazing. And so he's coming back. We're talking about Fred Bilo here, returning to Chicago in the early 1950s. And his jazz friends have kind of moved on. They're in other bands. Maybe some of them have moved out of the city. So he is now seeing kind of the lay of the land, and he's saying, hey, blues might be a better just job opportunity for him. But he doesn't quite know how to play the style of blues, but he is going to get introduced and kind of feel this thing out, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he went to school, actually, you know, for percussion, which is pretty intense, from this Knapp school, I believe it's pronounced, you know, and he met a fellow there who was drumming for Muddy Waters and was basically like, you know, blues scene people need drummers. Let me, you know, he came out of the army, and all his sort of jazzy friends, Gene Ammons, all these people he went to high school with, Johnny Griffin, they all sort of joined these really esteemed big jazz bands. So he was like, you know, so kind of made it his own, though. Like, you know, the blues shuffle sort of like doesn't necessarily have a, you know, an end, you know, and it's a lot of feel. And he sort of injected a, you know, a jazzy rhythm and sort of diligence to it that kind of gave it this swing that was unique, and joined this band, the Aces, and those guys played with everyone, including Little Walter, and suddenly he's kind of like a star of the blues scene. See the records he plays on, and it's just crazy. You know, he's playing with soul singers like Etta James. He's on doo-wop records. I mean, and then he's on, you know, ends up, basically he left the Aces and Little Walter and was like, I'll still play on your records. I like playing on records, you know. So he just became the Chess house guy, and Chess has like a little family of labels, Checker and all, and Argo. He could just do a lot, you know. And I figured out he put on some Bo Diddley records, and the guy who sort of, there's some dispute over who is playing that very iconic Bo Diddley rhythm on some of those records, you know. Some people say it's this other fellow, Clifton James. Some people say it's him. He says it's him, of course, you know.
Right.
Bilo in an interview said it was, but, you know, it's a very, very iconic rhythm, the, you know, shave and a haircut, two bits. That's a bit, you know, and you could trace it back, I'm sure, in earlier forms of music, but the Bo Diddley beat, it's kind of a big deal, especially in my world.
Absolutely. And I think in just in the world of music, or broadly. I mean, he's been called, Fred Bilo, the father of Chicago electric blues drumming. So if that's, that gives you any indication of how significant this guy is, he is responsible for the sound that we know today.
Yeah, and then, you know, even more perhaps that most people in the world have heard, he's on all this early Chuck Berry stuff. And that's where his rhythm sort of, you know, becomes the sort of like rhythm of rock and roll. And it's debatable what songs he plays on. I literally checked out multiple sources with people with different theories on which songs he plays on. But, you know, a lot of people say he is on, you know, rock and roll music, Johnny B. Goode, Memphis, Tennessee, all those sort of early jams. And that is, you know, that's just the blueprint for rock and roll, that stuff right there, you know. So, like, that he's not a wider known name than, you know, the guys who would go on to play rock and roll. Like, you know, he's not as known as a John Bonham or a Keith Moon or all these guys that probably heard his rhythm and were like, that's what I'm gonna do, you know. So it's important to give him his props here.
Absolutely. And he is going to eventually head on over to Europe, do some touring over there, and he's going to keep playing. I mean, Charlie Musselwhite on his record Stand Back, here comes Charlie Musselwhite's Southside Band, that's huge.
Another influential record, that really bridged that gap between, you know, the sort of old school blues, you know, cats, and then the new white boys, you know, that were coming up doing it, like Charlie and Harvey Mandel and people like that. And that record was huge on the West Coast, and even sort of kind of influenced the whole like West Coast counterculture, you know, sort of hippie movement, because they heard like, wow, these guys are like really good musicians and really know how to jam. We got to up our game a little bit, you know, and it's no, you know, Mandel moved out there, Musselwhite moved out to the West Coast. So again, another really influential, you know, sort of sound and record.
So Fred Bilo continues to play and record at least into the early 1980s. But then, as you say, the trail kind of goes cold and there's not a ton of detail about what happens in the 1980s. And we know how his life ends up.
Yeah, it's sad, you know, like I he was interviewed, thankfully. Huge props to this guy, Stephen K. Fish, I believe is his name, who sat down and did some great interviews with him in the 80s. And, you know, like, if you look online, some of the only information about him out there. And, you know, so luckily some people were realizing his importance. And if you look, all these compilations start coming out, collecting like the early, he's on some Buddy Guy stuff, he's on some Wolf stuff, all these compilations start coming out of that stuff. But again, probably people not exactly knowing, you know, who he is. And then, yeah, sadly he passed in 1988, you know, from cancer. So got him.
Well, he is a huge player in music. Fred Bilo on the drums, playing with some of the greats. We're just giving some love to the drummer today, because that doesn't always happen. And a lot of the drummers, like you say, Steve, that we've heard of maybe more famously got some of the influence from Fred Bilo. So we could check out the full story of Fred Bilo in the Chicago Reader this week and online at chicagoreader.com. Really quickly, Steve, sponsorship, Dusty Groove Records in Wicker Park. You love them.
They're great. They are going to have, you're going to find most of these records that Mr. Bilo plays on at that fine establishment.
Absolutely. On Ashland and Division in Wicker Park. And tonight at the Hideout in Chicago, it's the special celebration, 20 years of the secret history of Chicago music. Look at that. 20 years, Steve. So proud of you.
It is a milestone. I can't believe it. We had to do something to celebrate. Yep. right, you know, we only get one of these 20-year anniversaries. So yes, we're at the Hideout. We are going to do a sort of hybrid event, two like earlier in the day, starting 4:30 doors. it'll be panels, and I will be talking to some of these famous musicians, Jackie Ross, great soul singer, Ronaldo Domino, another one, the guys from Ono, this magical band from the 80s that very rarely make appearances. So there'll be these panels. I also have reader editors, Philip Montoro and Salem, there to sort of moderate. And then in the evening at 9:30, Ronaldo Domino is going to perform. He puts on an incredible show. One of the great and last living legends of like Chicago soul. Come see a guy at his peak. And yeah, it's all going down the Hideout. You can get kind of like a ticket for both, and we got a little food truck in between too if you're down for a whole day of secret history mania.
That's what it is. It's secret history mania. That's today at the Hideout, 1354 West Wabansia in Chicago. It's a cozy room. I love, and I say that in a good way, I love the place. It's a great historic venue in Chicago. So go there today. See Ronaldo Domino. See Steve Krakow. HideoutChicago.com is the website. Hey, man, congratulations, 20 years. Well-deserved party tonight. And, hey, 20 more, right?
Here's the 20 more. I'll be pretty historical myself. Sincerely.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 974 is done. I say thank you so much for listening to the show today. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering help in the WGN radio studio. Have a wonderful week. Happy Father's Day weekend to all the dads out there. Happy Father's Day, Dad. And I'll talk to everyone again next time right here on Outside the Loop.